Hello again, everybody. I'm sitting here today with Roy Small of the Heart Group and Joe Contra of Infectious Disease Specialists. We're going to talk about something that has become a hot topic and a very confusing one, and that's the subject of antibiotic prophylaxis. It's a subject that we were very comfortable with for a long time because the last guidelines from the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology on antibiotic prophylaxis for endocarditis were updated in 1997. So for more than a decade, we thought we knew what we should be doing. But just this year, a committee of the Heart Association College of Cardiology has recommended substantial changes in the regimen for antibiotic prophylaxis. There's been considerable discussion and confusion about these changes, and we're going to have a roundtable discussion today that covers both the infectious disease and the cardiology side, and hopefully by the end of this discussion, you will know what you should be doing and feel comfortable about it. So, Joe, let me turn to you first and ask why, after more than a decade, the Heart Association and the College of Cardiology felt that a change was needed in these guidelines.
Well, Larry, over the years, it's been very clear through a number of tenets that prophylaxis is a reasonable endeavor, and those were based on certain pieces of scientific information which are relatively well known. It's known, for example, that endocarditis is a very serious disease, that the organisms that cause endocarditis tend to come from or be similar to oral flora, and that dental procedures produce bacteremias with those same organisms. Furthermore, in animal models, it had been demonstrated that under certain circumstances, antibiotic prophylaxis of bacteremias could prevent endocarditis. So the fifth tenet is that, of course, that this would work in humans as well, and that has always been the sequence of thinking that led to antibiotic prophylaxis recommendations. I think what has changed is the fact that there's, over the last decade or two, a paradigm shift away from expert opinion and towards evidence-based medicine. And I think that that type of change in religion, if you will, has led to a reevaluation of all the scientific data or lack thereof in this particular case, and has caused a complete turnabout in terms of who deserves prophylaxis and who does not.
Well, it's my understanding that the basis for the new recommendations has been, first of all, to divide people into different risk subsets. Roy, could you just clarify the changes that have been made in terms of the risks that people are and how that influences the recommendations?
Well, the major change is, given that activities of daily living, for example, brushing your teeth, are associated with bacteremia consistently, that patients with any kind of heart lesion are repeatedly exposed to bacteremia. And so if you have intermittent exposure to bacteremia, does it make any sense to give a prophylaxis for just another episode, even though it's a predictable one? That plus, even if antibiotic prophylaxis were completely effective, were 100% effective, you would prevent a very small number of cases. So that the change has been to focus rather on patients who, if they were to get prophylaxis, would be at a substantially higher risk because of their underlying disease. So they've removed patients, for example, with mitral bowel prolapse, a very common disease, from the antibiotic prophylaxis recommendations because they have a constant low-level risk of bacteremia. And if they were to get endocarditis, the disease would not be of that severity. The only patients who remain on the recommendation list are those who would have a much higher risk should they develop endocarditis.
So mitral prolapse, you're telling us, is a low-risk subset and therefore is no longer on the list of people who should receive routine antibiotic prophylaxis for dental work.
Correct.
What is the high-risk subset then?
So the high-risk subset are patients who, if they were to develop endocarditis, would have a much more serious outcome. So the patients are those with congenital heart disease that have not been corrected. Congenital heart disease that's been recently corrected within the last 6 months. Those who have a residual defect after a partial correction. And then those with prosthetic valves or patients who've had previous episodes of endocarditis. Those are the patients who would have the most serious consequences should they develop endocarditis. The interesting part about this is, if you think about this, and you understand the source of confusion because it's a bit of a non sequitur. On the one hand, we say, well, there's no reason to prophylax patients who have abnormal valve, let's say mitral valve prolapse, because there's a low-level bacteremia that happens every single day, as it does with somebody who has a mitral valve prosthesis. But yet, if you're going to have dental work, well, okay, then we're going to prophylax you if you have a mitral valve prosthesis, but we're not going to prophylax you who have mitral valve prolapse.
Well, what I'm hearing from you is that the difference between a low-risk and a high-risk group is not based upon their risk of getting endocarditis. It's based upon the severity of the consequences if they should get endocarditis.
Exactly, and that's how the American College of Cardiology and the AHA have dealt with this, by a level of evidence. And in other words, even with patients with a prosthetic valve, it's a level 2A. It's not a level 1 recommendation. It's a level 2A recommendation, and the strength of evidence
meaning
is
what?
B. Meaning it's, we think this is a good idea. It's reasonable to do that, but it's not the strongest recommendation we can make, and it's based on limited evidence.
Joe?
If you think about it, the working group could have let the pendulum swing all the way. Their conclusion in the paper is that, well, there's really not any good evidence that prophylaxis benefits people, period. And yet they still picked the high-risk group from the old recommendations and left prophylaxis on board for them, not because there was evidence that it works to prevent endocarditis, but because there's evidence that that patient population would have the most severe complications and morbidity and mortality associated with endocarditis if they got it. And admitting that there's clearly a lack of good studies to show one way or the other, but they decided to take the most high-risk group and make those the target of the prophylaxis regimens.
Well, let's face it, the only reason not to give prophylaxis is emergence of resistant bacteria and the risk of a reaction to the antibiotic. Those are the two major factors, are they not? So what we're saying is that in people whose endocarditis, should they get it, would have such severe consequences, we feel that those consequences outweigh the societal risk of emerging resistance and the personal risk of a reaction to the antibiotics.
Exactly.
Do I understand that
exactly.
Correctly? Okay. Well, I can say as a surgeon, there is no question that the prosthetic valve population, which is the high-risk group, endocarditis in that population is serious business. They invariably end up with another heart operation. Their valve has to be changed, and it isn't always easy or safe to do so.
We should clarify at this point that we're only talking about dental prophylaxis.
Right. We can move on to prophylaxis for GI procedures, such as colonoscopy, or GU procedures, such as cystoscopy.
And here the recommendations are simple. No evidence. No evidence to prophylax patients for those procedures.
Regardless of the risk group that they're in.
Correct. There's no data. I mean, there's no recommendation because there is no data.
The caveat of which is that you must be very careful to be sure that the tract that you're operating on with your endoscopy is free of infection. Not necessarily free of microbes, but free of active infection. So the recommendation is that if you're a urologist doing a cystoscopy, that you are sure that the patient does not have an active urinary tract infection. And if you're doing an ERCP, for example, on a patient with obstructive jaundice, that's a situation where, by definition, there is infection in the biliary tree, and so that patient should be prophylaxed. But certainly for standard endoscopic procedures, screening colonoscopies, for example, in the absence of clear-cut infection, there's no evidence to support the need for prophylaxis.
But if you are prophylaxing for an infected GU tract or GI situation such as obstructive jaundice, even the low-risk set should be prophylaxed, is what I'm hearing you say.
Well, no, actually the recommendations are that we reserve prophylaxis per se for the high-risk group. Now, remember that if you have, in the example of obstructive jaundice, you're getting an ERCP with a stent. If there's infection present, everyone should be on antibiotics because there's infection present. It's not really prophylaxis per se. So I think we're in those situations, we're slipping out of the definition of prophylaxis.
Because we should be treating the infection anyway. So the question that I asked really doesn't come up. You don't have that dilemma of the low-risk patient. They should be on antibiotics anyway. What about the antibiotic selection? Has that changed at all, or we continue on in the same way?
Well, the if you look at all the previous iterations of the guidelines dating back to 1955, almost every year, or almost with every iteration, I should say, there's been a significant change in what's recommended. So I think it's a matter of there being some continued evolution in this. The recommendations currently are not too dissimilar to what we've seen previously. Amoxicillin as a 2-gram dose given preoperatively within 30 or 60 minutes of the procedure is still the standard. And there are, of course, pediatric dosing guidelines as well for patients who are allergic to penicillins but who do not have an anaphylactic reaction. You could use a cephalosporin or, of course, clindamycin or one of the other macrolides could be used. But the idea of a single oral preoperative dose is, carries through all those recommendations.
But isn't there now a diminished use of antibiotics after the procedure?
Well, yes, the recommendations at this point don't call for any postoperative doses. Even from the old animal studies, we know that the duration of bacteremia is fairly short. And in human studies with dental extractions, for example, the bacteremia beyond 60 minutes is quite unusual.
The last question I'd like to ask before wrapping this up has to do with the role of the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee in this hospital. Will they come out with an official statement, or at least will they come out with a statement that says, follow the guidelines?
Yeah, I think the role of the P&T Committee is to provide guidance for physicians who are understandably confused if they haven't particularly read through the entire document or understand the rationale behind it. Just looking at the prophylaxis cards, for example, that physicians often carry around, it's a very different document than it was in the past. And so I think the role of the P&T committee could be to advise physicians as to why the changes have taken place and to make sure that they are up to date on the exact new recommendations.
Well, I think that will be important because I won't presume to think that everyone on our staff is going to listen to this interview. But hopefully, we've clarified some of these issues. And I will mention, just for those listening, that this original publication of the new guidelines appeared in Circulation, which of course is the Journal of the American Heart Association, in April. The Heart Association makes a reprint available to anyone who calls, and the number is 800-242-8721. Of course, you could go on the web and just Google antibiotic prophylaxis guidelines, and it's no problem at all to find the guidelines online. Any final comments?
There are some special situations where there are no guidelines. And what comes to mind is a gentleman who is having a colonoscopy later this week who has a VAD, who has a ventricular cyst device, which is a huge amount of prosthetic material. Frequently they get infected. And we have made the decision to prophylax him prior to his colonoscopy. That's the current treatment regimen at other VAD programs. That is an extension of what we think is probably a good idea. There's no data.
Well, since you bring that up, that raises the question of patients with pacemakers or defibrillators. What's your policy for them?
Pacemaker and defibrillators clearly shouldn't receive prophylaxis for routine colonoscopy or endoscopic procedures.
The recommendations do allow for degree of the practice of art of medicine in that they do state that under other special circumstances, physicians could opt to do something other than the exact recommended guidelines, and I think the VAD situation is a good example of that. I think the idea is to take away that burden of standard of care that everyone should be prophylaxed and limited to those patients who are really going to benefit from it. But that does not disallow the use of prophylaxis in other special circumstances as deemed appropriate by the physicians involved.
Well, there's no question that one of the expressed reasons for making these changes was because of some confusion that has given an opportunity for malpractice claims that perhaps can be prevented with clear-cut guidelines. And I think the Heart Association was quite clear about that objective. Is there anything else, Joe?
Well, yes, Larry. Actually, the new AHA guidelines open up the way for much-needed research on endocarditis. Remember that our recommendations, while they're purported to be based on evidence-based studies, really contain a large amount of intuition still. It would be now ethical under the new guidelines to withhold prophylaxis from patients with mitral valve prolapse or bicuspid aortic valve and to properly study them. We could take 10,000 mitral valve prolapse patients, for example, and randomize them to either receive dental prophylaxis or placebo and follow them for 5 years, say, and the study would actually be able then to answer many questions. And I think the thing that we really need in endocarditis is randomized studies, which up to this point have really been lacking.
Well, that's a very appropriate note on which to end, with a view to the future. And I want to thank both of you for coming to discuss this subject, which has been confusing to many people, I know. And hopefully this discussion has cleared up some of that confusion. Thanks again. Well, I think that winds it up for this issue, our holiday issue of 2007. I wish all of you a happy holidays. Thanks for being with us, and we'll look forward to being with you again in the spring.